The name Nehemiah signifies consolation from God, and this is what we will receive by a consideration of some of his experiences recorded in the book which bears his name. Nehemiah was the son of Hakaliah of the tribe of Judah, of one of the prominent Hebrew families of the Babylonian captivity. The Medes and Persians had conquered Babylon, the second universal empire represented by the breast and arms of silver of Nebuchadnezzar's vision now ruled the world. Our story starts at about 445 B.C. at Shushan, the palace of Artaxerxes, king of Persia. Josephus tells us that Nehemiah was a very young man at this time, probably in his 20s. In spite of his youth, he held a high rank in the royal court, that of cupbearer to the king. This title, sometimes translated butler, is somewhat deceptive to modern ears and does not give the proper conception of the dignity of the position. His duties did not consist solely of tasting the king's food and drink to prevent poisoning. He was, in fact, one of the most trusted officers of the realm, a confidant of the king, always at his right hand, one whose advice the king valued and sought, what we would today call a minister of state. Daniel held a similar position in his time in the universal empire of Babylon. As confidential officer and counselor to the king, it was Nehemiah's duty to be acquainted with the mood and temper of the people. To do so, he was able to advise the king of any potential threat to the empire. To this end, it appears to have been his custom to mingle unrecognized with the people in the marketplace, and especially among those in arriving caravans, who could tell of conditions in other parts of the realm. Josephus tells us that he was doing this one day when he heard some new arrivals speaking the Hebrew language. He engaged them in conversation and was delighted to find that one of them was a close relative returning from an extended visit to Jerusalem. It was a tribute to Nehemiah's upbringing in the faith of his fathers that he eagerly inquired respecting the Holy Land, the Holy City, God's Holy Temple, and the condition of the Jews who had, years before, returned from captivity in Babylon under the proclamation of Cyrus. He was deeply interested in the welfare of Israel. Now let us read from the record in Nehemiah's own words in Nehemiah 1:2-4. Hanani, one of my brethren, came, he and certain men of Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews which had escaped, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. And it came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and wept, and mourned certain days, and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Do you see how keenly young Nehemiah felt about his people? How closely he identified himself with them and the holy city? He had never been to Jerusalem. He had never been there. He had never seen the city. All he knew about its former glory was from nostalgic accounts by his parents and others of the captivity. Yet he was deeply moved and distressed to hear of the devastation and degradation of Jerusalem, so much so that he wept. And it is an evidence of his great faith in the God of his fathers that he immediately and naturally turned to prayer. Let us consider some aspects of this beautiful and effectual prayer, which is found in Nehemiah 1:5-11. I beseech thee, O Lord God of heaven, the great and terrible God, that keepeth covenant and mercy for them that love him and observe his commandments. Then in this prayer, Nehemiah made a confession, not only for himself, but for all Israel. He said, both I and my father's house have sinned. We have dealt very corruptly against thee, and have not kept the commandment, nor the statutes, nor the judgments which thou commandest thy servant Moses. A confession of sin should be a part of every prayer. Then Nehemiah reminded the Lord of certain promises he had made to his people. He said, "Remember, I beseech thee, the word that thou commandest thy servant Moses, saying, If ye transgress, I will scatter you abroad among the nations. But if ye turn unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though there were of you cast out into the uttermost part under heaven, yet will I gather them from thence, and I will bring them unto the place that I have chosen to set my name there." In saying this, Nehemiah cited to the Lord his own edict of Leviticus 26:33. "I will scatter you among the nation, the heathen, and you will draw out a sword after you, and your land shall be desolate, and your cities waste." This is exactly what had happened to the Holy Land and the city of Jerusalem. This was a curse upon Israel because of their disobedience. But Nehemiah was a good Bible student. He also knew that a blessing was promised if Israel obeyed the voice of the Lord. He called to mind and cited to the Lord the promise of Deuteronomy 30:1-3. "And it shall come to pass, when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations whither the Lord thy God hath driven them, thee, and shalt return unto the Lord thy God, and shalt obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children, with all thine heart and with all thy soul, that then the Lord thy God will turn thy captivity, and have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the nations whither the Lord thy God hath scattered thee." You see what Nehemiah did here? First, he quoted to God his own words, that he is a covenant-keeping God, a God that will surely perform what he has promised. Then he reminded the Lord of a promise he had made to regather his people under certain circumstances. Then he claimed the promise. This is reasoning with God. Then he concluded this prayer by specifically referring to the distressed inhabitants of devastated Jerusalem, who desired to return to God and prosper. He said, "Now these are thy servants and thy people, whom thou hast redeemed by thy great power and by thy strong hand. O Lord, I beseech thee, let now thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant and to the prayer of thy servants who desire to fear thy name, and prosper, I pray thee, thy servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man." The one referred to as this man was Artaxerxes the king, an absolute monarch, not accountable to any parliament or laws, whose every whim was law. History records that he was an arbitrary and self-willed ruler, easily aroused to violent anger, often killing on the spot those who offended him. Artaxerxes was also called Longimanus, which means long-handed. His right hand was longer than his left. He was proud of this deformity, claiming it was the result of his frequent and sudden use of the sword. And this is the man through whom Nehemiah must work to accomplish his purpose. Nehemiah did not pray only once and then wait for the Lord to answer him. He says that he prayed day and night. So this prayer is merely a summation of what he prayed continuously for 4 months. We know this because the first verse tells us that it was in the month Chisleu when he learned of the plight of Jerusalem and began to pray. And we are told in Nehemiah 2:1 that it was in the month Nisan when he finally received an answer to his prayer, a lapse of 4 months. If his custom was the same as that of Daniel, who prayed 3 times a day with his windows open toward Jerusalem, Nehemiah must have uttered the sentiments of this prayer at least 360 times. The answer came suddenly and unexpectedly. The king had prepared a banquet for his nobles, at which the queen also was present. We can imagine that the guests were all attired in their best silks and jewels, and were smiling and joyous. Nehemiah, as usual, was at the king's right hand, so that he might taste of the food and wine before it was served to the king. As he served the wine, the king glanced up and noticed the contrast between Nehemiah and the happy guests. He saw a sadness and pallor he had never seen before. After all, let us remember that Nehemiah had not only been praying, but had also been fasting, eating sparingly for 4 months, sorrowing in behalf of his people. He was gaunt and hollow-eyed. Artaxerxes placed his hand on Nehemiah's arm. "What's troubling you?" he asked. "Everybody else is happy and you are sad. Are you sick?" "Oh, no, your majesty," Nehemiah replied, trying to smile. "I am quite well." The king's eyes bored into his own. "Well, then," he said, "if you are not sick, it must be a great sadness of the heart. It shows on your face." Nehemiah was terrified. As he himself expressed it in Nehemiah 2:2, "Then I was very sore afraid." Or, as Moffat puts it, "I was dreadfully afraid at this." Why was he so frightened? It was because he well knew the temper of his king. He had seen this man summarily thrust through with his sword any who offended him. Nehemiah realized that his sadness of heart might be misconstrued. It might indicate to the king a spirit of discontent and a loss of interest in his duties, even disloyalty and treachery. An urgent, silent prayer went up to God, and Nehemiah quickly recovered his poise. He instantly realized that this might be the Lord's doing, providing just the opportunity he sought. We read his words in Nehemiah 2:3-4. "And I said unto the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad, when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed by fire? Then the king said unto me, for what dost thou make request? So I prayed to the God of heaven." The exact word that he should speak to the king now came easily and readily to his lips, as though prompted from above. "And I said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldst send me unto Judah, into the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. And the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, for how long shalt thy journey be, and when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time." And it was no short time either that Nehemiah set. We know from Nehemiah 5:14 that he asked for and got a 12-year leave of absence. It took great courage for Nehemiah to make the request he did. The king could easily have considered the rebuilding of the walls and the gates of Jerusalem an act of rebellion against his rule, a desire by Nehemiah to set up a nation of Israel as a separate and rival government with himself as king. In fact, we read in the 4th chapter of Ezra that this same king, Artaxerxes, had previously stopped the restoration work of Ezra because of similar accusations. So when Nehemiah asked for what he did, he laid his life on the line. And he won because the Lord had answered his oft-repeated prayer, "Grant me mercy in the sight of this man." Nehemiah had complete confidence that his prayer would eventually be answered. He didn't know just how or when it would be answered, but he knew that it would be. He had complete faith. We know this because he had carefully planned in advance just what he would need for the success of his undertaking. just what he would request of the king when the opportunity came. He didn't have to go away and figure it out and then come back and ask the king for more favors. He struck while the iron was hot without hesitation. This is evident from the next two verses, Nehemiah 2:7-8. Moreover, I said unto the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace, which appertaineth to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me according to the good hand of God upon me. So we see that Nehemiah had the necessities of the work all laid out in his mind. He had done his homework. And this also indicates how closely he had previously questioned his kinsmen as to the details of the damage which must be repaired. Such foresight and thoroughness impressed the king with his wisdom. He not only granted Nehemiah's request, but gave him what he had not requested. He appointed him governor of Judah and gave him a strong military escort of cavalry befitting a governor. A four-month journey brought him to Jerusalem, where Nehemiah was welcomed by the desolate city's inhabitants. He did not at first reveal the object of his coming, nor the fact that he had been appointed their governor. To them, he was simply a visiting dignitary, a wealthy young Hebrew who had attained high office in the Persian government. This they could see from his military escort and the richness of his caravan. He wanted to first make a personal appraisal of the situation. After 3 days of mingling with the people and becoming well acquainted with them and their tribal rulers, he secretly made his inspection of the ruined city. He waited until everyone was asleep, and then on horseback, accompanied by a few trusted servants on foot, he toured the broken walls by moonlight. We read his own words in Nehemiah 2:12-16. And I arose in the night, I and some few men with me, neither told I any man what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem. Neither was there any beast with me save the beast that I rode upon. And I went out by night by the gate of the valley, even before the dragon well, and to the dung port, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates thereof were consumed with fire. Then I went on to the gate of the fountain, and to the king's pool, but there was no place for the beast that was under me to pass. Then went I up in the night to the brook, and viewed the wall, and turned back and entered by the gate of the valley, and so returned. And the rulers knew not whither I went, or what I did, neither had I as yet told it to the Jews, nor to the priests, nor to the nobles, nor to the rulers, nor to the rest that did the work. This moonlight ride must have been a distressing experience for Nehemiah. If before he had wept when he had merely heard of the plight of Jerusalem, how overwhelmed he must now have been to see it with his own eyes. But now he had first-hand knowledge of the facts. What he had seen confirmed the feasibility of his plan for rebuilding. The next morning he called together the elders and prominent representatives of the people and explained to them the real object of his coming. He showed them his authority from the king and told them how God had heard his prayer and how wonderfully he had prospered in this undertaking. Then he outlined to them a method whereby the repair work could begin immediately. We read his words in Nehemiah 2:17-18. Then said I unto them, ye see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no more be a reproach. Then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, as also the king's words that he has spoken unto me. And they said, Let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. Do you see how Nehemiah was able to inspire the people? He fired them with his own zeal. It was they who said, Let us rise up and build. And as they went to work, Nehemiah worked with them. He worked as hard as any of them, with his hands, with stone and mortar and heavy timbers. Why was the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem considered so important? Was it merely a status symbol? No, it was not only that. There was also a very practical aspect. When the city walls were broken down, the enemies of the Jews raided and robbed them regularly. They were at the mercy of every nomadic tribe that chanced to ride that way. But if the walls were repaired, it would be a different story. My Bible dictionary says of the original walled city, Jerusalem was almost an impregnable Gibraltar. The steep sides of the ravines on the east, the south, and the west provided bulwarks against siege. The north was the only direction from which a foe could attack the city under the conditions of ancient warfare. Through many trials and difficulties and discouragements, which very well could be the subject of another discourse, the work progressed. Every difficulty was overruled by the Lord, and the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem with the original stones was completed in the incredibly short time of 52 days. Now let us consider some of the valuable lessons to be learned from this account. Although Nehemiah was a very young man, he was held in high esteem by the king as possessing rare ability. This reminds us of Paul's words to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4:12, which I will read from the Weymouth translation. Let no one think slightingly of you because you are a young man, but in speech, conduct, love, faith, and purity, be an example for your fellow Christians to imitate. The younger brothers and sisters of our fellowship should not be despised. It must not be presumed that they are shallow because they are young. This is a serious mistake. Stephen, too, was a young man, but in a matter of a few months he made his calling and election sure. By contrast, I have been in this narrow way for 58 years. The Lord held young Stephen in such high esteem that he was accounted worthy of the honor of being the first to follow his master's footsteps even unto death. The fact that Nehemiah was so carefully reared in the faith of his fathers has a lesson for those of us who are the parents of young children. Just as Nehemiah was born in Persia and received his formal education in that heathen nation, our children are subject to the influences of this present evil world. But these influences can be counteracted by godly parents. Nehemiah's intensity of feeling for the welfare of Jerusalem indicated that this had been accomplished in his case. Similarly, it is our privilege and duty to imbue our children with the truth, with a feeling for the Lord and his people. As Nehemiah was taught the Hebrew language by his parents, we can teach our children the language of the truth. Who knows if the Lord may not draw them and use them for some exalted service as he did Nehemiah? Let us at least prepare them for the Master's use. As Nehemiah was in Persia, but was not a Persian, the Christian is in the world, but not of the world. Jesus said of such in John 17:16, They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. No matter what our positions in the world, whether high or low, our primary interest should be the welfare of Zion. We should have an intensity of feeling for the truth and its service, praying for opportunities and ready to act when the Lord opens the way. The thing that particularly distressed Nehemiah was the condition of the walls of Jerusalem. We read in Nehemiah 1, 3, and 4 that they reported to him, "The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire." Then he gives us his reaction to this report, saying, "And it came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and wept." Without walls, Jerusalem was no city. It had no cohesion, no integrity, no honor. Enemies could invade and rob and plunder it at will. It was a byword and a laughingstock. In the words of Nehemiah 2:17, it was a reproach. The church, as established by our Lord and the apostles, was a city or community of God, as we read in Hebrews 12:22 and 23, "But ye are come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven." The primitive church was a city that had walls. It had integrity and cohesion. It was held together by a strong faith in the truth, the faith that was once delivered unto the saints. The great divine plan of salvation was understood. As Isaiah 60:18 expresses it prophetically, "Thou shalt call thy walls salvation and thy gates praise." This most holy faith was its protection against the assaults of the adversary. The walls of sound doctrine kept the church apart and safe. But after the apostles fell asleep, the walls began to be broken down. Paul foresaw this, saying in Acts 20:29 and 30, "For I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock. Also of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things." False doctrines and evil practices began to be introduced into the church. Paul's prophecy of 2 Timothy 4:3 and 4 was also fulfilled. "For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts shall they heap up to themselves teachers having itching ears. And they shall turn away their ears from the truth, and shall be turned to fables." As the great Antichrist system developed, the walls of Zion were broken down more and more, until in the Dark Ages little remained of the original structure of sound doctrine. Even the great foundation stone of the ransom was lost amid the rubble. Then came the Reformation, and the walls began to be rebuilt in spite of great opposition. David's prayer of Psalm 51:18, echoed by faithful Christians, began to be answered. "Do good in thy good pleasure unto Zion. Build thou the walls of Jerusalem." Truths long lost sight of were rediscovered and placed in their proper settings. The work of rebuilding accelerated. Then Christ returned, and by the hand of a faithful and wise servant, the structure of sound doctrine was rebuilt to completion. And don't forget that Nehemiah used the same old stones to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. He did not quarry new ones. Similarly, it was the old, old story, the faith once delivered to the saints, that was restored. There is a tendency to disturb the walls of Jerusalem again. Some feel that they can improve the walls by substituting new stones for the old ones, by changing the contour, chipping off a little here and adding a little there. Such feel that they know more about how it should be than the original architect and the faithful restorer. I don't think they do. Then there is another meaning to a city with broken down walls. It is a more personal application and is given in Proverbs 25:28. "He that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that is broken down and without walls." The spirit referred to here is the spirit or disposition of mind, the thoughts of the mind which control our actions. We must rule our thoughts and imaginations and cast out and keep out anything unprofitable to us as new creatures. Our warfare is in the mind. The new creature is developed in the mind. The new creature must use our fleshly minds as its instrument, making it a captive of the new will, the mind of Christ. This is concisely stated in 2 Corinthians 10:5, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. This is not something which is easily accomplished. The building of stone walls is not easy. It takes energy and stamina. Those who come into the truth have their spiritual walls in various degrees of disrepair. Some of us have more work to do than others, but as we learn to exercise self-control, first in little things, and then persistently and progressively conform our thoughts and words and deeds to the perfect standard, we will gain in strength of character. This is illustrated by the legend of Milo of Croton. To develop his strength, Milo one day lifted a small calf to his shoulders and carried it for a mile. The next day he did the same thing, and the next day, and the next day. He carried that same animal for a mile every day for 4 years. As the calf gradually grew, Milo's muscles developed correspondingly, until at the last he was able to carry a full-grown ox upon his shoulders. Of course, our flesh will never be brought under complete control, but the will must be there. The spirit must be ruled. Such a development of character is highly prized by the Lord. He has caused to be written in Proverbs 16:32, "He that ruleth his spirit is better than he that taketh a city." As Nehemiah earnestly prayed for the welfare of Jerusalem and of fleshly Israel, our earnest prayers should be in the interests of Zion for spiritual Israel. Our Lord's instruction to his disciples in Luke 10:2 are still good. "Pray the Lord of the harvest that he would send forth laborers into his harvest." In harmony with this, our resolution is, "Daily will I remember at the throne of heavenly grace the general interests of the harvest work, and particularly the share which I myself am privileged to enjoy in that work." We should, as Nehemiah was, become personally and emotionally involved. Thinking of our part in the Lord's work, we have a work of development in ourselves. We also build up one another in the most holy faith, and we witness to the world as we have opportunity. And as Nehemiah cited and claimed God's promises to Israel, we should claim and lay hold upon all the exceeding great and precious promises, that by these we might be partakers of the divine nature. Sometimes when things seem to be going the worst, they are really going the best. When the king noticed and commented on his paleness, Nehemiah says, "Then was I very sore afraid." He thought the worst had happened, and that he might lose everything, although it's really the beginning of the answer to his prayer. A good maxim is, when in doubt, pray. Another way of stating the same thing is, when your knees are knocking, kneel on them. At the time of his greatest fear, Nehemiah prayed, and this was his instant and automatic reaction. As we read in Nehemiah 2:4, "Then the king said unto me, For what dost thou make requests? So I prayed to the God of heaven." It was a silent prayer, a prayer of the heart, and the answer came instantly. This time it didn't take 4 months. So let us never be terrified when everything seems to be going wrong. It may be, as the poet has said, "The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head." Nehemiah had prayed, "Grant thy servant mercy in the sight of this man," and he got the help he sought. Similarly, in the language of Hebrews 4:16, "Let us therefore come boldly into the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Nehemiah was undoubtedly one of the faithful ones referred to in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, who will be princes in all the earth. He fits the description. He wrought righteousness, obtained promises, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness was made strong. He had trial of cruel mockings, of whom the world was not worthy, and he finally obtained a good report through faith. And Nehemiah said at the last, "Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and wipe not out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God." Then in Nehemiah 13:22, he refers to his restoration of Sabbath observance and expresses his heart's desire. "Remember me, O my God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of thy mercy." And his last words in the last verse of his book are, "Remember me, O my God, for good." Do you see how Nehemiah casts himself on the mercy of God? We can do this too. We can pray, "Remember me for good. I don't know how faithful I have been. I have tried so hard. I cast myself upon thee. Into thy hands I commend my spirit. Remember me, O my God, for good."